Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with two top House Republicans, Mike Turner, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and Michael McCaul, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, both expressing concern that Russian propaganda has found a foothold amongst fellow Republicans and has, quote, infected a good chunk of my party's base, according to McCaul. Joining us is an expert on propaganda, Renee Hobbs, an internationally recognized authority on media literacy education. She has worked to advance the quality of digital and media literacy education in the United States and around the world, and is the founder and director of the Media Education Lab at the University of Rhode Island, whose mission it is to improve the quality of media literacy education through research and community service. Then we'll assess the mental deterioration of the propagandist-in-chief, Donald Trump, and speak with Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis, and his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now out in an updated paperback version. Then finally, we'll look into the Biden administration's effort to get around the Supreme Court's blockage of debt relief for students with a Plan B announced today. Joining us to discuss the $1.7 trillion debt burden holding back the lives and futures of millions of Americans is Kevin Carey, the Vice President for Education Policy at the New America Foundation, where he also directs their education policy program. Previously, he worked as the policy director for education sector and as an analyst at the Education Trust and the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. A regular contributor to The Upshot at the New York Times, he's the author of The End of College, Creating the Future of Learning and the University of Everywhere. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Renee Hobbs, who's an internationally recognized authority on media literacy education. She has worked to advance the quality of digital and media literacy education in the United States and around the world, and is the founder and director of the Media Education Lab at the University of Rhode Island, whose mission is to improve the quality of media literacy education through research and community service. Welcome to Background Briefing, Renee Hobbs.
Happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Renee. And on CNN's Sunday program, State of the Union, Mike Turner, the chair of the United States House of Representatives Intelligence Committee, said, I quote, "It is absolutely true. We see directly coming from Russia attempts to mask communications that are anti-Ukraine and pro-Russia messages, some of which we even hear being uttered on the House floor." And of course, earlier on, Michael McCaul, the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, told PUC News something similar, that, quote, "Russian propaganda has made its way into the United States, unfortunately, and it's infected a good chunk of my party's base." So am I naive, Renee, in thinking that representatives in the Congress should be a little more educated and a little more sophisticated, not to fall for Russian propaganda?
Well, you know, it turns out that we're all vulnerable to the allure of propaganda, because when propaganda activates strong emotions and simplifies ideas, and especially when it taps into our deepest hopes, fears, and dreams, then we're all vulnerable to it. I think the conspiracy theories and the false information that are circulating, that are the kinds of Russian propaganda that are now circulating, can be very attractive to Republicans. For example, the whole Putin is anti-woke right? Putin's a source of traditional values. This is almost laughable, right? To anyone who knows facts and information about the situation of Putin's leadership, but it can be appealing to conservatives who are trying to create a us versus them framework that might be appealing to conservatives.
So in terms of the work that you do then, Renee, what can be done in terms of media literacy in this country, if indeed a big chunk of the country, and I'm not sure what percentage, is in effect illiterate when it comes to media literacy?
Yeah, well, there are three great simple strategies that we always recommend people start with. Because today, because of social media, we're often not aware that we're getting Russian propaganda, right? It doesn't announce itself. It's not labeled, right? So to recognize it and resist it, the first thing we have to do is examine our own biases, right? And recognize that our biases lead us to find some information believable when it matches our existing ideology, and notice where Russian propaganda might be framed in a way that taps into something that you already deeply care about. A second thing that we absolutely recommend and we teach people how to do is how to examine the source of the information and trace information back to the source. Of course, anybody can do that pretty easily right now. If you're looking at was Ukraine involved in that terrible massacre at the concert hall, right? Well, you can trace that back to Russia Today. Right? It's right there on the website. It's being pushed really heavily without any evidence, without any information. So examining sources is a really good way to start to recognize and resist propaganda. And the third thing we recommend is really to consider the context in which propaganda is useful. Like, ask the question, whose interests are served by these messages? That can help us understand the motivations to circulate propaganda. And I think that's those three skills together really help people become media literate news consumers.
And what about the news organizations themselves? I mean, we have a problem in this country that newspapers and television, to some extent, have to print the truth, otherwise they face libel, and you know there's fact checkers, etc., on newspapers. Not that necessarily has stopped Fox News from becoming a propaganda outlet, but nevertheless, at least there are some restraints where in the mainstream press you can't print what you think and believe, but what you can prove. But there's no such restraint on social media, which unfortunately is where most people get their information, is it not?
Absolutely. And in fact, we know that people have a very hard time distinguishing between what we would call legacy journalism and the new stuff that is just called digital content, right? Created by anyone for any kind of motive or any purpose. It's because of the rise of digital content and especially that opinion-driven journalism that examining the source and considering the context is super important, but it's also important to understand the economic motivations, right? Propaganda is disseminated widely for pleasure, power, and profit. And propaganda's ability to attract eyeballs with strong emotions and eye-catching headlines, shocking information, and oversimplified information means that propaganda can be profitable for digital platforms and content providers. So viewers and readers have to be on alert for how their attention is being commodified by propaganda.
So one of the more appalling statistics that came out recently was that since the January 6th insurrection, which we all saw live on television, and the people that sacked the Congress and beat up the cops. We all saw the most appalling behavior and some dreadful people, and the crazy guy with the horns. And then they defecated in the corridors, and they wanted to hang Mike Pence, and they wanted to kill Nancy Pelosi. I mean, it couldn't have been more ugly. But 3 years later, we find out that it's almost doubled the number of people in this country who think that January the 6th wasn't such a bad thing, and that these people that have been arrested and put in jail are martyrs, which is what, of course, Trump has been propagating. Is that a comfort factor? Is that to do with the fact that if you're a sort of Republican, you don't want to think, my God, this happened in the name of our champion, so therefore we just have to believe it really didn't happen, or wasn't as bad as it looked at the time?
You know, it is. It's I'm thank you for pointing out. It's absolutely shocking and heartbreaking to see that kind of unreality. And I'm also astonished by the it's now up to 23% of Americans say that violence may be needed to restore our democracy. So how I interpret it is that for almost all of human history, whatever the strong man said, the people in power have the ability to define reality for the rest of us. And that's always been true. And we saw that in times of dictatorship and autocracy. We saw that across Eastern Europe. We've seen it throughout all of human history. And I think what we're seeing here is another attempt, right? For people who are feeling buffeted by the vast income inequality that is rising and rising, and the problems that just don't seem to get fixed, there's a comfort and a sense of belonging in following the leader and the leader's ability to define what reality is. Well, it makes your job a lot easier, doesn't it? I mean, just follow the leader. So if you're overwhelmed with the complexity of contemporary life, the vision that the Republicans are offering is a compelling one, and it's being made attractive through an army of propagandists inside and outside of the journalism business, and by politicians who recognize the benefits of constructing a reality that gets them reelected.
But back to the Congress, the fact that you have two senior Republicans, one Mike Turner, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and the other Michael McFaul, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, both saying that their colleagues, and they're referring, of course, to the pro-Putin caucus,
yep,
in the House, largely led by Marjorie Taylor Greene, that they're parroting Russian propaganda. But there's a real effect, which is that they're holding up money for Ukraine.
That's right.
And Ukraine's running out of ammunition, and Russia could win the war because a handful, I mean, we're talking about a minority of about 10 people, yep, are holding up the will of the majority. So there are real world consequences. And if you're in Ukraine, it's just got to be absolutely infuriating to see what's happening here with the Congress. So
it's why we have to understand that as a tremendous act of courage on behalf of those two Republican members of Congress who understand that you can't close your eyes to the reality. You can't create fiction and expect to make good decisions when it comes to public policy. So they're to be commended, and I think more exposure on this topic also helps the public to be more informed, to help the public understand where we ourselves might have been exposed to Russian propaganda and our own, what do they call it? Ukraine fatigue might be affected by the kinds of messages we've seen across our Facebook and Instagram on this topic. So it invites us to look at our own vulnerability to propaganda as well.
But there is a chain of command, if you will, in terms of who's behind blocking the aid, and that is Donald Trump, who we don't quite know the extent of his murky relationship with Putin, but he keeps praising him and recently said if, you know, NATO countries didn't pay up, he'd encourage Putin to do whatever the hell they want to do with NATO countries. I mean,
and also, how about his claim that he could the war could be over in one day? Well, because if he gives away Crimea and Donbass and basically capitulates to Putin, so yes, some of that stuff is ridiculous.
But he's in turn pressuring Mike Johnson, who apparently is capable of doing the right thing, but then he's being terrorized by Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's already filed the papers to vacate the House chair.
Yep.
And we saw that sordid movie before. So this is what's going on. I mean, they wouldn't be getting away with it, but for the fact that there's some sympathy for them out there, and that many Americans, and I don't know what the percentage is, have literally bought the Russian line. And you think a lot of it's to do on the conservative side, too, because he's against gays and lesbians and woke people, right?
That's part of it. I think another very effective set of conspiracy theories that has stuck in some circles is the economic cost of this war for the U.S. and the issues of is the money being spent well? Is there a need for tougher oversight? Concerns about bioweapons. I mean, the conspiracy theories that circulate about the war, and you know what? War has always been prime time for propaganda. Another historical reality where it makes it very hard during this wartime for us to sort out what's truth, what's accurate, what's inaccurate. And because journalists have to verify information, which is hard to do in wartime. There's a whole realm of opinion, speculation, and conspiracy theories that are pretty vivid and dramatic and compelling. And those things, we know that opinions and emotions affect people more than facts. So that's what we're seeing right now as we encounter this Ukraine fatigue, especially after the Israel-Gaza, conflict, that people's capacity to manage the emotional stress of these two wars is just very, very challenging, leading to a breeding ground where propaganda can thrive.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Renee, there is, of course, a candidate running for president who most of his political life, so to speak, has been about promoting anti-vax theories and other conspiracy theories. So what's your sense about Robert Kennedy Jr.? Why is he doing what he's doing? Because all of these third-party candidates like Kennedy and Jill Stein and Cornel West, they have to know that they're not going to be president of the United States. It's just not going to happen. It's not in the cards. It's not mathematically possible. So why are they doing what they're doing?
Yeah, I think that's thanks for asking that really important question and connecting the dots here. If you think government is corrupt, flawed, and harmful to American business, American public, then destabilizing government is an effective strategy. And so I do think that when information warfare is part of the domestic front, then politicians like Kennedy, anti-vax activists who are disenfranchised from, quote unquote, the establishment, I think that there's a form of power that comes from maybe not being able to actually win, but to destabilize the existing power structure. And I think that's what's motivating him. And I hope it's not effective, but it could be.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, though. Do we have any numbers on how many people in this country are susceptible to conspiracy theories? I mean, QAnon, my God,
the thing is, Ian, we're all susceptible to conspiracy theories. We're all susceptible to propaganda. And we absolutely have to look inside our own hearts and our own minds as we reflect on how our biases predispose us to believe certain things that, you know, that we want to believe, how willing we are, and how hard it is for us to believe things that are outside our comfort zone. The most media literate people I know are people who have a lot of intellectual humility, who question what they think they know, and who are open to new interpretations. It's folks who are absolutely convinced of a certain X, Y, or Z reality that ironically are most vulnerable to propaganda. So keeping an open mind and an open heart is going to be critical as we move into this next phase of the election propaganda we're about to face.
Well, you're describing how journalists should be, which is we should be skeptical. We shouldn't believe the first thing that we hear. We should explore all aspects of stories and find the facts and do so without any kind of ideological blinders on. I get so many emails from listeners saying, offering up the craziest ideas, you know, and then they attack the mainstream press and for saying stuff that they don't want to hear. When you think about it, Renee, the Associated Press, if they printed conspiracy theories instead of the facts, they'd be out of business in a day, wouldn't they? I mean, we all depend upon the AP because they're reliable. And at the end of the day, does that matter? I mean, can we have some standards where we can rely on the truth?
Well, you know, I'm not as optimistic as I used to be. And that's partly because we have a whole generation of news avoiders who are explicitly choosing not to look at stories from AP, who are explicitly relying on opinion journalism and thought leaders to harvest their beliefs, attitudes, understanding of the world around them. I feel like one of the things we have to confront is the reality that, you know, a good story is undeniably life-changing, life-altering. Although journalists call their stories, right? Mm-hmm. Narratives have heroes and villains and victims and helpers. Stories are what change people's minds. So I feel like as much as we're going to need strong journalism to get for this post-truth crisis that we're experiencing right now, we're also going to need more and better storytellers who can activate people's feelings and ideas and maybe to help us come together across the ideological divide to find common ground.
Well, Renee Hobbs, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks again, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Renee Hobbs, who's an internationally recognized authority on media literacy education. She has worked to advance the quality of digital and media literacy education in the United States and around the world, and is the founder and director of the Media Education Lab at the University of Rhode Island, whose mission is to improve the quality of media literacy education through research and community service. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing the mental deterioration of the propagandist in chief, Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Alan Francis, who's a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference works Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis, and his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now at an updated paperback version. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Alan Francis.
Hey, Ian, always a pleasure.
Well, thanks for joining us. And we were just speaking with an expert on propaganda who teaches media literacy about how the two top chairmen on the Republican side, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Turner, and the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Michael McFaul, have both said that, in fact, McCall said that Rupper, well, they both said that propaganda has made its way into the United States, and McCall said, and unfortunately, it's infected a good chunk of my party's base. And that, of course, is what's holding up aid to Ukraine and the directions that the new House Speaker, Mike Johnson, gets is from Donald Trump. And we don't know exactly why Donald Trump, what his relationship with Putin is, but he certainly is helping Putin out in Ukraine. And Putin clearly wants him to come back. And that's the best way that for Putin to end the war in Ukraine is to have Trump reelected and then pull out of NATO and force Ukraine into giving up a massive amount of territory. So that's the situation. Now, what I don't understand is how Trump, who, as more and more you see him on the stump at these rallies, seems to be deteriorating mentally before our eyes. At the same time, he still has this tremendous hold over the GOP and this grip on them. And through sheer willpower, he has created this fiction that he won the last election and that it was stolen from him by Biden, and that the people who stormed the Capitol on his orders on January the 6th were just trying to right a wrong, and they're heroes and martyrs. And we learn that 3 years after January the 6th, more Americans believe in Trump's big lie. So how are we supposed to navigate between those two? The liar who seems to be going completely off the deep end and the lies that have metastasized and grown more powerful?
Well, several questions have occurred to me about these issues, Ian. The first is Trump really demented? The second is, if he is cognitively impaired, how would we compare any cognitive impairment he has with Biden's, which has been much more publicized? And the third is, what would be more dangerous, a demented Trump or a typically, con man Trump? And the answers to the three questions are completely unclear, but I have tentative thoughts about it. Is Trump demented now? Well, you know, I've been following Trump for 50 years. He always seemed demented to me. He always said stupid, incoherent things. And he always got away with it. And whether at this point he's more cognitively impaired than usual, or whether it's just a matter that he's more exposed and overexposed than usual, and maybe his grandiosity has increased to the point where he realizes he can say anything, however seemingly incoherent, and get away with it, whether that's taken off some of the filters. I think that the question is clear, that he is certainly more unhinged than he's been, but whether that's because of dementia, not clear. It may just be his position and the exposure. And it's absolutely clear that his cognitive functioning is horribly more impaired than whatever slips Biden makes. So there's a tendency for the echo chamber of the right-wing communication, powerful communication networks, to take every misplaced word that Biden utters and see this as proof of his being demented, whereas Trump every single day is completely incoherent, says the stupidest, most lying things in the world, and somehow he's given a bye. I think that the question of whether Trump is more dangerous if he's demented or more dangerous if he's intact is a tough one. I think if he is cognitively impaired, then it makes it more likely that he might impulsively press the nuclear button or more impulsively impose domestic tyranny in a way that would be astounding and quick and Nazi-like. On the other hand, if he's not cognitively impaired, If he's just crazy like a fox, Trump could be even more dangerous in setting up a permanent dictatorship in the United States and maybe a dynasty of the baby Trumps becoming the leaders of the country into the foreseeable future. So I think the last question that occurs to me after all this is, how can people not see through this? I think you and I and others like us, it's just so obvious that everything's a lie, that many of the statements are ad lib incoherent, and absolutely divorced from any sense of reality. How can 75 million people, pray at this altar? And I'm more worried about the cognitive functioning of the American people than I am about the cognitive functioning of Trump. I'm hoping, I think the best chance in this election is that he really screws up, that he keeps talking, that he keeps saying the things he's saying, and that finally some of them sink in enough for enough voters in swing states to swing the election in the favor of reason and rationality. I think that the fact that Trump Social is tanking so quickly, that it's lost more than half its value in about 10 days, if Trump Social goes bankrupt and a lot of ordinary people lose their money because of it, maybe people will begin to realize that this emperor finally realized this emperor has no clothes.
So is there a possibility, though, maybe it's wishful thinking, I recall that movie, Padachevsky's movie Network, where Peter Finch is this network anchor on TV who just goes off the deep end and starts having everybody shout out the window, mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. A similar thing, could that happen with Trump, where he's at one of his live rallies and he's almost off the deep end quite often in these rallies when he gets on a riff? Is it possible that there's a breaking point between those that adore him and those that are terrified of him, that he'll just simply transgress into loony land?
Well, I would have thought that breaking point occurred 30 years ago. And certainly enough things have been said and done by Trump over the course of the last 8 years that you'd think there had been maybe a dozen or more breaking points. The hope is that the accumulation of horrible statements and terrible lies and the fact that he's promising a dictatorship, essentially, and that the people behind him already have an 875-page document created by the Heritage Institute on how to institute a dictatorship, that hopefully that will get through to enough voters. But the past is not a promising prologue to the future, since this has happened so often along the way, and he keeps getting passes each step of the way. So could he possibly say things more outrageous than he said already? He said Putin was brilliant to attack Ukraine. He was, praising Putin up to the point that Putin murdered Navalny. No one flinched. And the question is whether the abortion issue will be enough. And even the trouble is that Trump is sometimes crazy like a fox. So yesterday, he's been talking about he does not want a national abortion plan that should be left to the states, that he's for abortion in the interest of the health of the mother for incest and rape. So even though he has said and will continue to say really crazy things, either he or the people handling him have so far been able to pull back enough so that he's not totally implausible to 75 million Americans. Again, I don't think any minds will be changed. I don't think many minds will be changed. I think that the minds are mostly fixed. I think the question is getting out the vote. And the more stupid things he does and says, the more likely it is that some people who might vote for him either won't vote at all or might possibly consider voting for Kennedy or for Biden instead of Trump. But we have to hope that things collapse, and they can collapse either through him getting even more bizarre. They can collapse through Trump Social losing its value and that pointing out his inherent sort of cheating of his followers, or it looks dimmer and dimmer. It may be that one or another of the courtroom proceedings happens in time, although the timeline on that is beginning to look unpromising. Again, how can Americans do this? Can we really be this dumb a country? And if we are this dumb a country, then I think that we have no one to blame but ourselves.
Well, the enablers, of course, you mentioned the Heritage Foundation's plan 2025. It's just they are thoroughly evil people who want power in the worst possible way and turn this country into a dictatorship. And also the billionaires, the plutocrats, a lot of them cut off Trump after January the 6th, were appalled by what happened with the assault on the Capitol. But they've all come around now because Trump is going to cut their taxes. And if Biden gets in, he would sunset the Trump tax cuts for the super rich in 2025. So those people would rather spend money having Trump reelected because they save so much money by not paying taxes. So they've got all this money to invest. And they bought the Supreme Court already, and they may end up buying the executive branch, possibly even the legislative branch.
One encouraging thing there is that Biden is raising a lot more money than Trump is. And that in some ways, it's puzzling, and it suggests that maybe some of the billionaires have second thoughts. Another possibility that would really turn the election, but so far hasn't happened, would be that the traditional, you know, core of the billionaire class, the traditional core of the Republican Party country club set, would begin turning on Trump. And you mentioned at the outset of our discussion just now that two congressmen finally fed up enough with the doings of the Freedom Caucus have said that they're Russian plants. That if we had a substantial number of members of the House, Republican members of the House, turning against the plants, if we had a substantial number of billionaires coming out and saying, you know, maybe my own tax situation would be benefited by Trump, but I don't want to live in an autocracy. Could that happen in the 11th hour to save democracy? Sure could. And the fact that the money is piling up on the Biden side and very, very stingily being contributed to Trump is, I think, one of the hidden, most optimistic, in some ways, I think, a more powerful predictor of the election than the polls.
So you don't think there's enough suckers out there to buy his Bible for $59.99?
I think that there's a limit to how much low-income people can contribute to billionaire Trump. And the fact that he's having a lot of trouble now raising small donor money, he's having trouble raising big donor money, both of those are very encouraging signs. And again, if Trump social tanks, as it really should, and today it lost 10% today, it lost 12% on Friday, it's now less than half its highest value 2 weeks ago. If it tanks, Trump would lose $3 billion personally or more. And I think a lot of small investors will have lost money. And maybe that would be the one thing that finally would convince at least enough people to win the election that he's just a con man.
Well, that, of course, should have been obvious back in 2016 when Mitt Romney said exactly that. He said, this guy's
Mitt
a con
Romney,
man.
A lot of these Republicans have to start saying, I'm not just not going to vote for Trump, I'm going to vote for Biden. I mean, a lot of high-level Republicans are so far either not endorsing or saying they will not vote for Trump. But not many of them have come out and said courageously, I'm for democracy, I'm going to vote for Biden. I may hate Biden's policies, I've been a Republican my whole life, but Trump is dangerous to America. We really need a large contingent of people to come forward at this point and really take into account the fact that this could be the do-or-die election for democracy. It's not an exaggeration to think that the leader of America that would follow Donald Trump would be Donald Trump Jr. And after Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump.
I mean, I know what you're saying, and it's all frighteningly real. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Very good, Ian. Always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now out in an updated paperback version. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Biden administration's efforts to get around the Supreme Court's blockage of debt relief for students with a Plan B announced today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kevin Carey, who's the Vice President for Education Policy at the New America Foundation, where he also directs the Education Policy Program. Previously, he worked as a Policy Director of Education Sector and as an analyst at the Education Trust and the Center for on Budget and Policy Priorities. He's a regular contributor to The Upshot at the New York Times and the author of The End of College, Creating the Future of Learning and the University of Everywhere. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Carey.
Great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And obviously, Joe Biden wants to forgive student loans. And needless to say, it's good for him in terms of the electorate, particularly those in debt from colleges in across the country. Huge numbers of people are indebted. He's obviously losing a lot of young voters as a result of their opposition to Israel's war in Gaza. So we know it's an important political issue for him, but it seems that a lot of right-wing Republican judges appointed by Donald Trump, maybe they also see that and they're frustrating him. So what is the situation with Biden's efforts and the extent to which these courts are frustrating them?
Well, the Biden administration has used multiple different tactics to try to forgive some or all of the $1.7 trillion in outstanding student loans. The biggest thing they tried to do was a plan that would have forgiven $10,000 from essentially every federally held student loan in the country and up to $20,000 for loans for low-income students. That attempt was struck down by the Supreme Court last summer. They fast-tracked the lawsuit. It was a 6-3 decision along the pretty familiar ideological lines. And so that program was just rendered null and void. The Biden administration has done a lot of other things, however, worth noting, to forgive loans. They've actually forgiven about $140 billion of loans since they've taken office, using a variety of other programs, including programs that provide loan relief for public servants, loan relief for people who were defrauded by for-profit colleges, loan relief for people who have been permanently disabled. And so they're using every tactic they have. They've also announced a new version of another new loan program, which I think they're going to be announcing publicly this week, although, you know, the specifics of it are already pretty well known, that would basically try to thread the needle between something that is expansive and will provide relief to a lot of students, but also perhaps this time might survive scrutiny from the conservative Supreme Court.
Well, President Biden is in fact unveiling his new plan to forgive student debt today, Monday. And it's obviously designed to try and get around the Supreme Court and other court challenges. And he wants this age, obviously, this new package to survive these legal challenges. So he's targeting specific groups of borrowers for debt forgiveness, including those facing financial hardship. And one of the provisions under this new plan could reach up to 25 million Americans in order to cancel runaway interest. So the Biden administration is announcing that these historic steps reflect President Biden's determination that we cannot allow student debt to leave students worse off than before they went to college. That's a statement from the U.S. Undersecretary of Education, James Clavell. today. So it looks like he's announcing his plan B today.
Yes. Yeah. They, you know, they previewed this plan last August. Actually, they pretty much had it ready to go in anticipation of a loss in the Supreme Court. And they've been working their way as they have to through the federal regulatory process. There's a whole structure of laws that any federal agency, including the U.S. Department of Education, has to go through in order to make a new regulation. And they've been kind of diligently working away at that. And are, you know, have reached a new stage that they're announcing today. So yes, as you said, it is rather than one particular type of relief that would apply to everyone, what this is going to be is actually five different kinds of relief targeted different populations under different circumstances with different needs. As you said, the one that probably would affect the most people would be a cancellation of accumulated interest, which, to be clear, is not the same thing as total loan forgiveness. You would still owe the principal on your loan, but for certain kinds of borrowers, if their interest has been accumulating such that they actually owe more than they originally borrowed, which is not an uncommon situation for people, it would bring that back down to the original principal amount.
Well, consumer advocates have been criticizing the fact that these interest rates on federal student loans exceed 8%, which is really tough. There's no way that you can keep up with that. You can't even get to the principal, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what do you think then, Kevin, is going on with the Supreme Court, the six to three majority? Are they operating out of the law, or what is their reasoning? Or are they just simply, because it's a partisan court, they don't want Biden to benefit from canceling student loans?
Well, I mean, everyone has opinions about the Supreme Court and the way they choose to interpret constitutional law. So this is just mine. The previous plan was based on actually legislation that Congress passed in the 2000s that provided broad emergency relief powers to the president during a time of emergency. So the Biden administration cited the pandemic emergency, which there clearly was an emergency, and provisions in that law that clearly said that the president had the power to forgive student loans. The Supreme Court rejected that under what they have termed the so-called major questions doctrine, which is essentially a new doctrine that was put forth or invented by the conservative majority. It's been in the works for quite some time, but really reached full fruition just a couple of years ago, that in so many words says that they will reject new and broad interpretations of federal law that perhaps are unprecedented, are unusually large, were not contemplated by Congress. It's very much a sort of you know it when you see it standard, which doesn't give much comfort to progressives and Democrats, because of course the thing you know and the thing you see may look very different from the perspective of, say, a conservative ideologue like Clarence Thomas than someone else's point of view. It really seems to cross the boundary into ideological preference and political judgment as opposed to reading what the law says. But they have put this idea forward. And I think the concern is that they will apply the same harsh scrutiny to this new plan, which will certainly be challenged in the court. So there's no doubt about that.
Well, the plan that Biden announced in 2022 that the Supreme Court blocked last summer was going to offer $400 billion in debt relief for indentured students. I mean, assuming that this new plan B that is announced today is, as you say, will be challenged, how much do you think that's going to cut off the, what did you say, $1.7 trillion, the overall number in terms of student debt?
I don't think we have a exact estimate from the administration about what they think this is going to result in part because one of the provisions that they are proposing to put in place would provide additional relief to students based on their economic hardship. And that would be defined through a further developed process that hasn't been, you know, kind of completely established yet. So the $10,000, $20,000 plan was simple. and it was easy to estimate. You knew how, we know how many people there are with student loans. We know how much they how much debt they have. We know whether they would have qualified for the income provision. These new plans are much more complicated, and so I don't think we have an exact number on what they will comparatively provide.
But it's always seemed troubling to me, Kevin Carey, that the government is in the business of charging interest on these loans. And you would think that you, in an ideal society, and I imagine this is pretty much what you have in a lot of the other advanced countries, you want your students to be centers of investment, not centers of profit.
You're absolutely right. I mean, Congress could, if it wanted to, change the federal student loan programs to make them interest-free. That would just come at a cost to the federal budget, which is not to say that it's a bad idea, just that it would have to be balanced with all the other budget considerations. And I think congressional concern about spending has grown as the nation has struggled with inflation over the last two or three years. But this is a longstanding debate. It is a choice to charge interest on loans. How much interest is a choice? They could make the rate higher, they could make the rate lower. Because interest rates on federal student loans float with the overall rate of interest on federal securities. So as interest rates have risen overall in the financial markets, so too is the amount of money that student borrowers have to pay.
Hasn't this resulted in generations of young Americans becoming indentured before they get a job? And a lot of economists have suggested that this is very detrimental to the economy, where young people can't buy homes, cars, refrigerators, etc. So what's the logic here?
I mean, there's not a logic that proceeds from good public policy, in my opinion. We know the right way to do public higher education, which is to provide robust funding to public colleges and universities, need-based aid to people who have low incomes, so you don't have to borrow. And we have just, as a nation, drifted far, far away from that bargain, which we used to have one or two generations ago. We have, through neglect or deliberate choices, transformed ourselves into a debt-financed higher education system. And that leaves us with this enormous burden that is left on college students who, as you say, what we want is for them to be able to begin their professional careers and form families and maybe buy houses or move ahead with their lives, not tied down by this debt that they, in most cases, have no choice but to take. There aren't, many, if not most, high-paying careers require a credential. Students don't set the prices, and so they have to borrow. So these are all choices we've made. And I think, the Biden administration is to be commended for trying to undo the harms of past bad choices. But there's still a lot of work to be done going forward to prevent more debt from accumulating in the future. And that, I think, is the question that sits behind this whole debt forgiveness debate, which is that, we can do whatever debt forgiveness programs we want today. At the very same time, the Department of Education is continuing to make new loans, which means we're going to have to come and clean up the same problem in the future if we don't change the underlying structure of how higher education is financed.
But just in closing, Kevin Carey, there is this government-funded program that I think gives about, $30 or $40 billion a year to private for-profit colleges, many, if not most of whom, are complete scams, where young Americans, are quite often young veterans and people are trying to get into the middle class, minorities, kids mostly, enroll in these for-profit colleges and end up with a mountain of debt and a worthless diploma. Can't that be closed down and that money go towards what we're talking about here today, real needs, as opposed to, have taxpayers' dollars funding a bunch of scammers?
Well, no, you're absolutely right. And the Biden administration actually has, at the same time, moving ahead on all of these student loan forgiveness regulations, also been producing another set of regulations designed to crack down on for-profit colleges and basically run them out of the federal student loan program. So they're trying to do that as well. The idea is that if any program where students are borrowing too much money for a program that doesn't lead to good jobs, that they would just become ineligible for participating in the loan program. So they're working on that too.
But that would save a lot of money, wouldn't it? I mean, I know they have a powerful lobby, these crooked for-profit colleges, but it just seems so unbelievably corrupt to have the federal government subsidizing these crooks.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that's on the ballot this November. The Trump administration was incredibly permissive. It basically staffed the Higher Education Office in the U.S. Department of Education with former executives and lobbyists for for-profit colleges. And they were, they let the for-profit college just do whatever they wanted. They rolled back the Obama administration's attempts to regulate the industry, and then the Biden administration rolled back the rollback. So if Trump is elected in November, I assume we'll have the same situation again. It's what he did last time.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Kevin Curry.
No, thanks so much. It's been great to come back on the show.
And again, I've been speaking with Kevin Curry, who's the Vice President for Education Policy at the New America Foundation, where he also directs the Education Policy Program. Previously, he worked as a Policy Director for Education Sector and as an analyst at the Education Trust and the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He's a regular contributor to The Upshot at the New York Times and the author of The End of College, Creating the Future of Learning and the University of Everywhere. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone. One more light goes on in the